This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, listener, it's your host, Nick, here with a quick message before the show. If you enjoy this episode, learn something new, or just feel like helping us out, please consider following the show, subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, leaving us a 5-star review, or sharing this episode. All of these things greatly help the Birdshot Podcast and allow us to reach more and more listeners just like yourself. I would appreciate you taking just a minute to do any of those things. And if you really love the show and you want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, subscribing, and following, you could consider becoming a Patreon contributor, which gets you some exclusive discounts and promotions, some bonus content from time to time. You'd be eligible for any and all Patreon giveaways. And last but hopefully not least, I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me for your support of the show. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And with that said, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Jeff, thank you for joining us. I hope you're doing well, my friend.
Doing well. Yeah. Appreciate being on the podcast today.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. A former guest of the show kind of connected us. Now, you guys go back. Did he, I might be making this up, but I feel like Mike mentioned that you guys went to high school together or something.
We did. Yeah, there was a year between us, our classes. But yeah, I've known Mike since high school days. Yeah.
Gotcha. Where are you based out of, Jeff?
I'm in West Central Missouri. I'm about halfway between Kansas City and Springfield. I'm at the town I live in is called Clinton. We're on Truman Reservoir. If anybody's into crappie fishing or bass fishing, they probably know about Truman Reservoir.
How are the crappies biting these days?
Well, I haven't really kept up with it recently, but I can tell you that I saw something posted on Facebook here a day or two ago. Somebody had a picture of their graph that showed a big old wad of fish and said that the crappie were schooled up and they were ready to go catch some. Yeah.
Excellent. I have, the water up here is all frozen, but I have yet to drop a line through it, Jeff, as you can imagine.
Yeah, we don't get an opportunity to do much ice fishing here. Very seldom do we get enough ice to be able to get out on it. Maybe a little bit of pond fishing somewhere. So even if you do break through, you're only going to go to your knees, maybe.
Right. Yeah. At least up here, I shouldn't say that because, you know, the last few winters have been so mild that the ice conditions are kind of so. I think this year they're pretty good because we have not had a lot of snow and we have had some really cold temps. So I think the ice is pretty good. But again, that is far from my area of expertise these days.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what, there's a hard beat, a cold water bluegill. You can catch a nice mess of bluegill out of that cold water. Man, those things are tasty.
Mm. Yep. If I were to go ice fishing, that is more than likely what I'd be after. That we've got a little family cabin not too far away that the lake is pretty much filled up with crappie and bluegill. So that would be on the menu.
Yep.
We're not here today to talk about crappie and bluegill, Jeff. We've got other things to discuss. Why don't we start at the top and you give us a little bit of background on sort of what you do as you are professionally involved in this world of upland birds and habitats and conservation and a whole lot more. But are you the director now of the NBGI? And I'll let you tell us what that is.
Yeah. September 1st, I became the director of the National Bobwhite and Grassland Initiative. Our administrative home is at Clemson University, but I'm fortunate enough to be able to work out of my home here in Western Missouri. And we do have one staff person that works at Clemson University that also has a teaching assignment down there. That's our science coordinator. And then we also work very closely with the National Bobwhite and Grasslands Initiative Foundation, And there's a team of people there kind of scattered out across the country that are involved primarily in delivering an RCPP program, Regional Conservation Partnership Program, through the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. We kind of operate independently, but together. It gets a little confusing. The lines between the two of us are kind of gray, but the foundation is more the money side. The university, the initiative is more the science side of the equation. So.
Got it. Well, yeah. I appreciate that and definitely wanted to get you on today. I've been hearing a lot of chatter about grasslands and quail. I think quail specifically because I was considering doing a late season quail hunt this year. It didn't come to be. I will be traveling a little bit down to some quail country later this week and might get the chance to chase some birds. I'm not sure if it'll be wild birds or preserved birds yet at this point. But anyways, the grasslands conversation is one that is, seems to be more of it lately and wanted to go straight to the source. I meant to ask you this. You must know Kyle Hedges and Frank Longcarriage.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I know both of those guys really well.
So I interviewed them way back when. I don't recall exactly. I could look it up, but they're Missouri biologists, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And they actually authored they authored an article that I was reading recently that I was putting all these pieces together. I had a couple balls in the air and then I realized that they were all sort of the same ball. And a friend of mine, actually Kevin, was just down hunting with Frank and Kyle and doing a film that will probably be coming out. And that was down in Missouri. So I figured you guys must know each other. And I was reading their article in Project Upland magazine about the National Bobwhite and Grasslands Initiative, grazing, fescue grass, stuff that I want to ask you about. But before we get into that, I would be curious to hear how you got into the world of wildlife conservation and hunting and bird dogs and that sort of thing.
Yeah. The short answer is my dad. I think that's a pathway a lot of people have to get into the outdoors is through their parents, whether it be their mom or dad or an uncle or, somebody who's passionate about the outdoors. And my dad was, I would consider him to be the consummate outdoorsman. I mean, he did everything, all kinds of fishing, all kinds of hunting, he had, camping, canoe floating, you name it. If it was outdoors, it was something he did all the time. And my granddad, his dad wasn't that big of an outdoorsman, but he had an uncle, which would be my great uncle, that really introduced him to quail hunting. And, I remember as a kid, a real, young kid, I'd go quail hunting with my dad. He wouldn't let me carry the shotgun, but I carried a pellet rifle with me. And, it wouldn't be uncommon to shoot a rabbit or two while we were out on a quail hunt. But yeah, my dad introduced me to the outdoors and I mean, all of my formative time outdoors was with my dad and experiencing all of those different, outdoor, hunting and fishing experiences. And, so when I went to college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew when in high school I was pretty good at biology, so that really interested me. So, I went to University of Missouri and my first year I didn't even declare a major. I took a biology course and also I think it was an introduction to wildlife management. And man, after I took that introduction wildlife management class, the light bulb went off and it was like, this is what I want to do. I spent 4.5 years at University of Missouri, got a degree in fisheries and wildlife, and I've been working in the field, in the natural resources field ever since, kind of bounced around to some different things. Worked for the University of Missouri for a year, worked for Missouri Department of Conservation for about 5 years in a variety of temporary positions, went into private industry after that, worked in the native seed industry for a number of years, then worked for the now defunct Quail Unlimited. I worked for them for about 15 years. And then also, while I was working for Quail Unlimited, I was operating as a conservation contractor, doing a variety of conservation projects like prescribed burning and native grass planting and timber stand improvement, invasive species control, and all of that. So, you know, my history, my background is in conservation delivery, mostly, but also in my work with Quail Unlimited, I was involved in some policy type things with our state agency and USDA and that type of thing. And then in 2015, I had the opportunity to go to work for the National Bob Whiting Grassland Initiative as their grassland coordinator. And worked in that position. And then as times evolved and things changed, I became an assistant director. And then in September of 24, I became director of the initiative. So that's a life history there.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Yeah, it sounds like you were kind of on that path without knowing exactly what it was going to look like. You were on that path to wildlife conservation. And it's been a part of your life for a long time.
Yeah, when I came out of the University of Missouri, I my heart was set on being a waterfowl biologist. I had some waterfowl coursework, and that was where I wanted to go. But you know what? That's not where my opportunities came. And opportunities, you know, come along, and you take advantage of them, and that directed my career path. So, and I can't tell you today that I ever thought that I'd be in the position I am now. But again, you follow the opportunities that are put in front of you, and you know, here we are today.
Yeah.
So,
in reading your bio on the NBGI website, it mentioned something about the family farm there in Missouri. Are you still on the family farm? It's just going back to the 70s, I think.
Yeah, the early 70s. My mom and dad bought a place, and yeah, I'm still on it. My parents are both gone now, so I inherited the property. And then my wife, she passed away a few years ago, but before she passed away, we bought some additional property adjacent to it, so to add to it. So now I've got 170 acres of upland. Well, I call it upland. It floods occasionally when Truman Lake gets in the flood stage. I get water on it, but I manage it as upland habitat. Yes, you know, quail, or they've been my passion for, you know, I've been in the natural resources for 40 years, and I'm going to say quail have been my passion for 35 of the 40. So,
love it.
Yeah.
So would you say where you are, where the farm is, I mean, is that kind of ground zero for some of the quail conversation? I know they're a wide ranging bird, obviously, but you know, it's right there in your backyard. And I know we'll talk about grazing and some of the stuff that the birds are facing right now, but.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Nick. Help me out.
Well, it just as far as like you being there for such a long period of time, that being quail country, am I assuming too much that's quail country?
No, you're not. I mean, we're experiencing the same things that everybody else have. You know, we're experiencing declines in bob whites, you know, range wide. And it depends. There's different sources of information, but generally you would somewhere between 85 and 83% decline in bob white populations since 1970. And I might add to that too, that 1970, that's just because that's when the records started to be kept. If you go back and read some of the traditional literature on bob whites, back in the 40s, biologists were sounding the alarm about the decline in bob white populations, which it's really hard for me to fathom, you know, at my age, because the 60s was kind of the gold standard. And then the 80s was the gold standard. And I'm thinking a lot of people, at least my age, and maybe not quite as old as I am, but they probably still think of the 80s as when populations were really good. So, but yeah, now that I understand your question a little bit better, you know, I've watched that whole process through time. You know, the other part of that, with the work that I've had, I've done a lot of travel throughout the Midwest and the Mid-South and Southeast, and I've seen changes in the landscape. And though it's only anecdotal through observation, it pretty well supports what the science has told us about what's happening to bobwhites across the landscape. You know, we're just the loss of habitat. The fragmentation is probably just as significant as the loss. Reality is there's still a fair amount of habitat out there, but it is so isolated from other islands of habitat that it makes it really, really difficult, if not impossible, for any kind of population exchange to be able to maintain a sustainable population of bobwhite.
When the researchers were warning of the decline in quail, this is what I wanted to get to. At that time, whatever you recall or know of the history, were they warning of habitat loss? Were they warning of something else? Has it been kind of the same story over this whole period of time, or has that evolved as well?
Yeah, it's always been based around habitat loss. I would say early on, there was concern about over-harvest. But I think particularly through the 60s and beyond, the wildlife agencies probably addressed that adequately, where there weren't as major concerns as there were initially. It's been based in habitat, and that's what the National Bobwhite Grassland Initiative. That's what we're focused on is habitat. We understand there's a lot of other issues out there, but to keep from getting too far off of the main path, we're still focusing on habitat. And part of our program, part of the initial plan that was created, was to basically prove that it is habitat. And so we designed a system and a process for doing that. And for the most part, I've been successful with that, to be able to prove that. So maybe to get in a little bit more about the Grassland Initiative and where our science is on this.
Yeah,
and that'll be great. Yeah, I don't want to redirect your conversation here, but the National Bobwhite and Grassland Initiative began as a charge from the directors of the wildlife agencies in the Southeast United States. The Southeast Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies directors got together and said, hey, you know, we're seeing a decline in bobwhite populations. We want to gather a group of people together to look at this and see what's going on and create a strategy to address it, to deal with it. So in 1995, there was a gathering of people that initially was known as the Southeast Quail Study Group. So they met and they discussed the issues and they developed some action plans out of that. And then over the course of time, in 2002, they actually put a plan to paper in 2002. So they released that plan. Again, state agencies started to do some actions related to the things that were in that plan. And the plan was basically based on creating targets of acres of habitat improvement. And so that particular plan, after it was introduced, began to get the attention of other states outside of the Southeast that are still in bobwhite range. So eventually that led to the expansion of the Southeast Quail Study Group into the National Bobwhite Technical Committee, which included 25 states, which represent the core of bobwhite range. So basically it runs from Texas north to Nebraska, east to Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and then all states south and east of that imaginary line I just described. Yeah. So we operated under that plan for a number of years. And then in 2011, a new plan was written or a revised plan that the strategy was to involve biologists from all 25 states. As a result, there were 600 biologists from Bob White Range, from throughout Bob White Range, that developed this plan. And one of the tools that they created was what we call the Biologist Ranking Index. And the Biologist Ranking Index, where they designated polygons on the landscape for their potential of Bob White recovery. They had good or high, medium, and low. So a low area would be a metropolitan area. Opportunity recovery in metropolitan area is not good. Or a highly agricultural area, it would be a problem. So in addition to that, the medium area was, there was a chance for recovery. They, you know, with some work, they could do it. And then in high recovery, they felt like there was sufficient habitat. There was probably quality, quantity, arrangement of habitat. The opportunity for recovery was really good in that. So we basically have high, medium, and low categories for opportunity recovery. That then allowed the states to be able to identify geographies within their state that they could focus their effort. So the other thing that came out of that plan was the development of what we call the Coordinated Implementation Program. And this is where we get into the science of providing proof of concept that habitat is the main cause for Bob White decline.
This is the system that you referenced.
Yeah, the system that we referenced, this Coordinated Implementation Program. So what a state agency would do is they would identify an area that they were going to implement this plan. It had to consist of a minimum of 1,500 acres of Bob White habitat on no less than 25% of the landscape. That gets a little confusing, but if you had 1,500 acres of 100% usable quail habitat, that would be all the larger your focus area would need to be. But if you had 1,500 acres on a minimum of 25%, well, that would then be in your land, your focal area would be 6,000 acres. You follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah.
So a 6,000 acre might not be 100% quail habitat, but if a 25% of it was, you could still sustain a Bob White population.
Right.
So we had a number of states that would establish these focal areas, and they would monitor the habitat in years 1, 5, and 10, and they would monitor Bob White throughout the full 10-year period of this program. And then also they would have a reference area, which would be an area close by of very similar landscape composition, but did not have any kind of management taking place on it. That way you could show the difference between variables in weather, predator abundance, or any other external factors that might affect the population.
Your control, experiment control, basically.
Yeah, your experiment control, exactly. So what we found in a majority of those focal areas that over the period of time that in the area that was being managed at that level, there were seeing increases in Bob White populations, and in the areas that were not being managed, they were not seeing any increases, not necessarily seeing any declines. In some cases they would, in other cases they wouldn't. One of the interesting things, at least from my perspective, that came out of that is we did have some focal areas that did not show any increases through that time period. When we started digging into it, and we started looking at the data in the habitat, and what we found out is what people were calling habitat was not really habitat. Mm. So there was some lack of interpretation of what quail habitat is and what quail habitat is not. So that was limiting to a certain degree. But what we did find is when you have the right quantity of habitat, the right quality of habitat, and the right arrangement at the right scale, at a landscape scale, you can increase bobwhite habitat, or I mean bobwhite numbers, bobwhite right. population. So that's the challenge now, is to get all of those together. And really, it's the landscape scale that is our biggest challenge. We are currently moving into phase two of that coordinated implementation program process, where we are moving up to a larger landscape level, more or less at a county level, rather than at this 6,000 acre or even a 10,000 acre level. We're taking it up to a county level. This spring, we will be deploying 1,200 acoustic recording units across these focal landscapes that we've designated to start monitoring bird occupancy. Because of the scientific method, it's just impossible to be able to count numbers at that scale. The labor effort would be too huge. Mm-hmm. So we're doing these acoustic monitors, and then it's just going to be occupancy. Either they're here or they're not here.
Right.
But we're going to monitor that again over that 10-year period to see that as we do habitat improvements at that landscape level, are we picking up more locations that have occupancy? So we can couple that with that data. So that's our next step in the process. And again, we're launching that this year, and we have 5 years of funding to cover the data collection on that. So we're really excited to follow along and see what happens there.
Yeah. The acoustic recorders are neat. I've got a friend up here. He's a county forester, but they're doing some barrens habitat work, and they have been deploying some of those to capture turkeys gobbling and warblers and the stuff, the kinds of species that they're hoping to see and hear on this barrens habitat. So yeah, that's a neat way that you can do some research without having to have boots on the ground at all times out there.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll still follow up with a handful of points around those with actual boots on the ground. But that'll just be enough that'll be there to help, increase our confidence level for the acoustic recorders that are unmanned, and we don't go in and do that monitoring on those locations. So, that's pretty exciting that we're moving into this next stage now and see what we can do there. The question that I always have in the back of my mind is, we've got the science, we know how to do it. Are we going to be able to get society to support what needs to be done to make it happen? That's really the big question in my mind anyway.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that is something that I come back to in my mind a lot. We've talked about conservation issues plenty over the years on this podcast, and this is a small little audience, but I think about it like some of the membership groups, your Ruffed Grouse Societies, your Pheasants Forever, your Quail Forever, and throw a number at whatever the size of the organization is, 150,000, 10,000 people. It's a large group of people, and we do well to band together in many ways, but we are facing a country of millions and millions and millions of people, and the competing interests and what larger groups of people want, how they want to use the landscape. It just it seems like we're always up against that. So it's like, no matter how hard we fight, we're fighting an uphill battle, it feels. And I think that's absolutely the case. So it's not always, we might know the answers and we might have a pretty good idea of what needs to be done, but to your point, getting that done is probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I've often said, and I continue to say, that until we can get the person that's living in the skyscraper in New York or Los Angeles to understand the complexity of the issue and the absolute significance of the biodiversity on the landscape, it's probably not going to change. And the only way, in my mind, the only way we can do that is we have to put an economic value on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily just a dollars and cents economic value. I mean, it has to be a mental health value. It has to be a physical health value. It has to be, we have to make a connection between the habitat work that we're doing and the birds that we all love to go out and hunt, because those people don't give a rip about whether we hunt or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they should care about clean air, and they should care about clean water. And so, you know, those are the things that we need to try to sell and make the connections between what we're doing with those things, so that those people can see that, and support the kind of things that we're trying to get done on the landscape.
Do you think that that conversation is elevating a little bit in the last decade or so, as far as our, the society as a whole, our view on clean air, clean water? Because it feels like it with some of the conversations around pollinators, you know, native habitat. It feels like that conversation is elevating a little bit. Obviously, we're kind of stuck in our own silo all the time, 365. But
yeah, and that's been one of my arguments too. Is, you know, I go to meetings all the time, and you know, there's a lot of cheering, you know, rah rah, look at all this great stuff we're doing. But it's all the same people in the meeting I go to every mm-hmm. time. You know, so yeah, you're right. We're in our own silos, and our message is gaining momentum, and there's some excitement building around it. There's a lot of that is going on, but I fear that it is just within our group. We need to somehow get outside of that. But having said that, I do agree. The message is being elevated some, but it's, I think in the big scheme of things, it's only in a very minor way. So I may be misinterpreting it, but
yeah. Do I dare ask how AI is going to change the future of quail conservation?
Well, I don't know. I don't even know how to wrap my head around that. You know, my concern with AI, particularly where the source of information is coming from to build the AI around it. Let me rephrase that. If the AI is built within the science, I think there's some good opportunities. If the AI is built among the general access to knowledge on the internet, we might be in trouble because there's so much misinformation out there that it could really skew the results of the AI. But again, if it's confined to what the science is, I think it might benefit us in some way.
I'm kind of asking the question tongue in cheek, but I will say that there are very few areas, you know, AI is kind of this term that it's sort of become a blanket term where there was a lot of things that were happening within the last 5 years that we weren't calling AI, but now everybody wants to label everything AI. But right. as a blanket statement, it's going to bleed into many areas. And when it comes to science and research and aggregation of data and some of the stuff that it can do, I'm sure there will be breakthroughs or realizations because of it. So I haven't thought about it much as it relates to wildlife conservation. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it as far as how do I get more done every day?
Right. Yeah. No, I think the aggregation of data is probably one of the greatest benefits that we could see from that. Because currently may not be a correct statement. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, any way to aggregate data all had to be done manually. I mean, you had to go out and get it. And yeah, it might eventually get plugged in a computer to analyze it, but you had to aggregate it manually. So, it could make a difference.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about how working lands play a role in this. And I was going to ask, when you were doing phase one of the coordinated implementation, was that all public land, or is the quail range pretty much ubiquitous as far as public, private, you know, there's a lot of private land where this work needs to be done?
I don't know exactly what the number is nationwide, but I can tell you throughout Bob White range, we're looking at probably somewhere in the average about 85% private ownership. So if you're going to impact Bob White populations, it has to be on private land. Unless you're just going to create a museum population on a fish and wildlife area.
Right.
I don't see any way public land is going to accomplish a population recovery. And I had a point I wanted to make and I just lost it.
Working lands?
Yeah, working lands. Our focus areas are, our CIP focus areas. Yeah. Without going back and look at each one of them individually, we were probably 75 public, 25 private, maybe 80, 20.
Okay.
It is hard to do that kind of research on a private area where you can have 1,500 acres of habitat and 6,000 acre landscape. You know, that involves multiple private landowners. But we did have a couple of those, and we had some too that were a combination of public and private. So, and almost all of our reference areas are on private land, as you might imagine. So, we did incorporate some of that into it. But it was definitely most heavy on public land.
Cause that was really where my question was coming from. Just as you discussed sort of this coordinated effort with states, I was assuming that a lot of that work was perhaps done on public lands, which is just, I was just curious about, but in the reading and research I've done and knowing how big of a area that private lands and a role that private lands play, I know that's a big component of it. So let's talk about the working land side of things and some of the grazing stuff. Cause I found the conversation around sort of the fescue grass and the native grasses, sort of a classic, historical look back on, okay, we started using this fescue grass because it does one or two things really, really well. But then it turns out it has all these downstream effects of not being the best for quail and other wildlife. And maybe now we're rediscovering some of the benefits of native grasses for grazing and how that can benefit a whole suite of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before I forget it, because I have a tendency to forget things as the ideas pop into my head. When we talk about working lands, and particularly in this case, we're talking about grazing and tall fescue and integrating native forages into that. But also, want to include in working lands as we talk about the southern United States, those pine plantations, those southern pines that, there's a lot of opportunities for Bob White population recovery, Bob White management in those southern pines, those working lands as well. And not, the science is not so well known, but it's a developing area right now. Even the hardwood savannas of the Midwest can all be great Bob White habitat when they're managed correctly. So when we talk about working lands, we're not just talking about corn and soybeans and grass pastures. We're talking about forested landscapes, woodlands, managed in the correct way as well, that, they're also providing a working lands opportunity. And that's really where we intend to focus a lot of our effort. Our discussion about CIP a couple minutes ago was, we've done a lot of the research on public property, but it's a proof of concept. It's, it doesn't really matter that's where it took place. It's just, we've proven that if you do this, you will get this result. And so now let's transfer that to private land. So with that said, so now that I've taken us off track, let's get back on track with tall fescue and native forages. As it ends up, in the grazing system, fescue has its place. You had mentioned that there are some real advantages to it. And I can't imagine, and I wouldn't even advocate for somebody that's in a grazing system to and currently has tall fescue, I wouldn't say, no, you need to go eliminate all of it. Would I like to see that happen? Yeah, but economically, it's probably not a good strategy. Typically, when we're talking with livestock producers about converting a portion of their forage base to a native warm season forage, we're typically recommending anywhere from 25 to 30%, maybe all the way up to 50%. If it's something that they get some experience with and they're comfortable using and they really like, they might go as high as 50%. But mathematically, based upon the growing season, about 30% would be an ideal area. And there's actually been some research that's done that shows that economically 30% is kind of the sweet spot. In a combination with cool season forages, because for those that may not be familiar, cool season forages grow during the cool months of the year, warm season forages during the warm months of the year. So as you transition from spring to summer, you move your grazing operation off of the cool season forages onto the warm season forages. And then in the fall, as you transition back to cool weather, you would move your forage from warm season into the cool season. So that's the high level overview of how that, you know, that grazing season, grazing cycle goes. I don't know if we were on air, cause we did discuss a little bit before we started recording about visiting with Kyle and Frank.
Yeah.
And they had done some of that, involved in some of the research around Bob White responses to grazed native warm season forages. And, it across the board, it was better than ungrazed areas. I mean, nest initiation was earlier, clutch sizes were bigger, recruitment was higher, survival was greater. I mean, almost every metric you looked at, it was better in a grazed native grass pasture than it was in an ungrazed native grass pasture. And then compare that to tall fescue, which means there's essentially no nesting taking place. I won't say no, there's very little. And then typically after the nest hatch, there's no brood rearing habitat. So their survivability is really low.
So what is the issue with, just not to overlook it, what is the problem with the tall fescue, or what issues does it cause for quail?
Well, the main thing is that it grows really thick. It depending upon what source you look at, some places consider it a clump grass, other places don't. It behaves a lot like a clump grass in poor soils, but you get it in good soils and it's more like a sod forming. I mean, 90% of the lawns throughout the Midwest are tall fescue. It's a sod forming. The other thing is the grass itself has an endophyte fungus in it, which causes all kinds of problems. Not 100% proven yet that those problems transfer to Bob White's, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it does. It definitely causes problems in mammals, but we're not so sure. And the other thing is that people that graze tall fescue, if they're grazing it the way it's recommended, they'll typically graze it down to about 4 inches tall. There's no cover at 4 inches tall. There's just no cover there. So on one end of the spectrum, you have ungrazed tall fescue is thick and rank, and there's no way a bird could get through it. On the other end of the spectrum, you have a properly grazed tall fescue. It's only 4 inches tall. And there's no cover,
nothing there.
And then you even go one step further, which is more common than we'd like to see, is overgrazed tall fescue. And it's about the height of a top of a billiard table. It's grazed right down on the ground.
And it can from what I understand, it can tolerate that and bounce back. So there, people will graze it down to that sort of golf course putting green level.
Right. It's not 100% true, but it's a general statement that applies. I mean, the fact is if they're overgrazing it that way, it doesn't bounce back as quick. It doesn't bounce back as vigorous. They're, they're reducing the plant vigor, and over time, if they don't allow it to rest, it will not recover. And then those fields get weedy, and then guess what? They become quail habitat again until the fescue takes back over.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So not, I don't want to overlook this.
By the way, Nick, I want to make it clear. I am not recommending overgrazing.
Right, right. Okay. No, we don't want to do that.
No.
In the hopes that we'll get quail habitat back.
No.
There's better ways to go about that, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the thing that you mentioned about some of the work that sounded like Frank and Kyle got into was that there may be a sweet spot for, again, working lands, grazed native grasses. That was native grasses that were grazed were producing better metrics as far as nesting and quail populations.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that, I mean, the study that was done there in Missouri is not the only one that supports that. You know, the interesting thing is at University of Tennessee, there's a Center for Native Grasslands Management, and they've been doing research on native forages for, I don't know, probably going on 15 years now. Not only do they look at it from the wildlife side and the bird responses, but they also are looking at it in the animal performance. They're looking at the economics. They've looked at about every different aspect of the advantages of using native warm season forages in a cool season grazing system. And across the board, I mean, economically, they're cheaper. Your return on investment is faster. They gain more weight. Maybe let me put some context that gain more weight. If you're grazing tall fescue during the summertime, that's the time of year it's not producing very well. That's the time of year when the endophyte fungus, the alkaloid enzymes that are in that plant are the highest. So it creates the most problems for livestock. So generally, they don't gain very well, if they gain at all. So in the summer months, you can put them on native grasses and they'll gain in the neighborhood of two pounds per day in a growing class livestock. Now, not necessarily if you got a bull or you've got a lactating cow, that she's probably not going to do that. But if you've got steers or you've got weaned heifers or even calves, they'll gain in the neighborhood of 2 pounds a day. And then in the fall, they go back on the fescue and they'll continue to gain. So basically what I'm saying is the increased weight gain is that it's not necessarily increased over fescue during the appropriate season, but it allows you to maintain that level of gain during the summer. Whereas if you weren't grazing that, you wouldn't have any gain or you have very little gain. So that's, and then there's other issues with it too, besides the economics of it. The animal health is really important. Getting those cattle off of that endophyte infected fescue. The endophyte causes elevated body temperature. It's a vasodilator. It causes hoof rot. It causes issues with the tail switches because of blood flow. They'll end up losing the tail switch. They're constantly, they have a fever, so they want to seek out water. So that's why you see a lot of times you see a pond full of cows when it's not even that hot outside. They're standing in the pond trying to keep cool. It's because they're on that hot endophyte infected fescue. Their weaning weights are lower. Their conception rates are lower. There's just all kinds of issues. When you get them off the endophyte, all of those metrics go up. So there's a lot of economic sense in including native forages as a summer forage into these cool season systems.
Got it. All right, I'm going to try to make a comparison here just to help myself understand this. So you may not know this about me, but I'm a ruffed grouse guy. Well, you can probably see the feathers above my head there, but being in Minnesota, I'm a grouse guy. And so I'm familiar with the story of, you know, the working land story for ruffed grouse, in that modern forestry, we're mimicking disturbances that would have occurred, be it a fire or a tornado or something, where we create these disturbances, we create early successional habitat. is the grazing of the native grasses, is that similar to mimicking disturbances that would have been, you know, I associate quail with fire, right? Fire is one of the things that used to disturb the landscape and regenerate it and provide good quail habitat. So is the grazing mimicking that disturbance in some way? Is that kind of the basic principle?
It's difficult for me to say that it's mimicking it, because fire has such a specific, I don't want to say reaction, result. It results in such a specific reaction on the landscape. It's hard to say, but I mean, essentially what we're looking at when we're grazing is we're controlling the vegetation height. Generally it creates a heterogeneity in vegetation height. You have a lot of different heights. You have short, you have medium, you have tall. It reduces the accumulation of litter on the ground, and that's one of the issues as it relates to brood rearing. And quail chicks can't get around when there's a lot of litter on the ground. And that's why tall fescue is not very good. They can't work their way through all of that thatch that's down there. So it helps mediate that. You are right in that it is a disturbance. It is a natural disturbance. Before European man was on the North American continent, there were elk and there were bison and there were any number of grazing animals that were, creating this landscape. And then when you combine that with fire, and that's the interesting thing, when you combine that with fire, which you would have seen basically across our continent, as fire burned through grasslands and those grasses came back, that would concentrate the grazing animals.
Sure.
So when you think of terms of the Great Plains and large herds of buffalo, they would come into an area after a fire had been through there. Well, because that was rich and lush and nutritious and palatable forage, they would basically graze that down to the ground. You would have this huge herd come in there, and then when all the forage resources were gone, they'd move on to another spot. Well, then the next year or 2 years later, when the next fire comes through, there's very little fuel in that area, so it didn't burn. But it might burn the spot right next to it that didn't get grazed so hard and didn't have the fire on it. So when those animals come through again, guess what? They find the spot where the fire had been, and they graze that down. So that process has been mimicked with the patch burn graze approach, where we go in and we would burn an area of our forages and create a burned patch. And then when you give cattle access to that, they go and they graze the area that's been burned. So what we do in a patch burn graze system is we'll rotate that burn patch around the pasture. Or might take a pasture and divide it into three individual areas, patches. We'll burn one patch 1 year. The next year we'll burn another patch. The next year we'll burn a third patch. So the cattle will follow those burn patches around that pasture. So within that pasture, you have a huge variety of vegetation characteristics. You have a lot of different heights because of the differential way that they graze those plants. You have a different layer of thatch in there. The one that hasn't been grazed for several years is going to have thatch. The one that just got grazed, not going to have any thatch. And the one that just got grazed last year, the next year is going to be pretty weedy. So there's going to be a lot of forbs in there producing a lot of seeds. Those end up being ideal brood rearing areas. So it ends up being a very diverse system within a small scale, which really benefits the bobolites because they have a lot of different habitat types available within a very small area.
Got it. All right. I want to transition a little bit to sort of incorporate the Act for Grasslands that listeners may have heard of. That's what I've been hearing about a little bit more in the last year or so. And would love to get your perspective on, because I think NBGI is a supporter, or just how it aligns with your work, what what they're hoping to accomplish with the Act for Grasslands and what that could mean for future work.
Yeah, I may get a little off topic here, but it's all part of, I think, supporting the idea. I mean, I guess I'm trying to lay some groundwork to talk about the Grassland Act. So, yeah, the North American Grasslands Conservation Act is intended to raise awareness and provide opportunity to improve native grasslands across North America, which would include Canada and Mexico as well. So now let me back up a little bit on that to kind of set the foundation for this whole situation. In 2019, I imagine a number of your listeners were probably aware of this. In 2019, there was a report in Science Magazine about the loss of 3 billion birds. Now, technically, it was 2.9 billion, but, you know, we're going to round it up when we're talking billions. What's a few million, right? So, anyway, we've lost 3 billion birds, and that kind of sounded the alarm to a lot of people, not just in the bird community and in the wildlife community, but just conservation and people who are concerned about the environment in general and, you know, the place we call home. So when we look at that, when you look at the grassland birds, and by the way, bobwhite are included in that suite of birds, although I can say technically they are not a grassland bird. They're grassland feculative, which means they use grasslands. They're probably more accurately classified as a shrubland bird. But for the purposes of this study, they lumped grassland and shrubland together because they do have such a strong connection to grasslands, even though they use shrubs. So sorry about that, off on a tangent.
I learned something new.
Yeah. So anyway, when they looked at all of the different suites of birds, and these were like interior forest, forest birds, shore birds, wading birds. I forget what all the categories were, but there were, you know, different categories. Waterfowl was included in all of those, or water birds in general, which included waterfowl. When they looked at all of those, grassland birds had the most precipitous decline of all of the suites of birds. Over 74% of the species that were considered grassland birds were in decline. And we talked about this just a little while ago, Bob White's 83% since 1970, 85% depending upon what source you look at, definitely a significant amount since 1970. The interesting thing was, is when you looked at waterfowl, they had increased. And so the thought was, now we're going to get back to the Grasslands Conservation Act. Okay. So what's the difference between the waterfowl and the grassland birds on this? We got both ends of the spectrum. We've got we got an increase in waterfowl, and we have the most significant decrease in grassland birds. Well, in 1989, the North American Wetlands Conservation Act was signed into law. And that protected wetlands in the United States and in Canada and in Mexico. And it also established a no net loss policy, which meant if I had a construction activity that was going to destroy a wetland, I could build something there, but I had to go replace that with a wetland someplace else. So it was a one-to-one no net loss situation. Now, I won't say that that wasn't controversial, because I know there's a lot of farmers that were pretty upset with that designation of wetlands and the restrictions that were put on it. So I don't want you to get caught up in the idea that the North American Grasslands Conservation is going to do anything like that. But the overall was, look at what this Wetlands Act did to waterfowl populations. They increased it. We need something for grasslands that will do the same thing. Okay. So that was the idea behind the North American Grasslands Conservation Act. It was that the stimulus was created by the most significant decline in all birds' suites and the comparison with what waterfowl had done during that same time period. So that was kind of the initiative behind it. So when we come to the Grasslands Act, though, what basically what it's going to be set up to do is create a grant system that would be totally voluntary, that landowners will be able to apply for funds to assist with management of their grasslands. Maybe it's prescribed burning. Maybe it's a, maybe it's grazing management. You know, maybe it's to come up with a grazing plan that is, that will help sustain the grassland instead of overgrazing it and beating it into the ground and no help of recovery. And then it's like, oh, this stuff's no good. Let's plant something in exotic here because I can abuse it. So part of it will be educational. Maybe it's going to be restore grasslands. Maybe there's some agricultural grounds that are currently being farmed that shouldn't be farmed because of erosion problems or whatever. But the whole idea is that it's to infuse money into a system to be able to not only save existing grasslands, but to improve management of existing grasslands and to help restore grasslands. There's also a component of that that is to support the native seed industry with the realization that if this act is successful and you get a lot of people wanting to do restorations, it's going to put a big demand on the seed market. So they're, you know, they want to address the availability of seed and help support the, those markets and help develop plant materials that would be made available for purchase for these restoration activities. And then an interesting little tidbit of it, and this is really comes more from the Western states, is they want to put together a research pilot around regenerative grazing in arid grasslands. You may have heard a lot of discussion over the years about Bureau land management and their grazing policies and how the ranchers that are leasing the ground or overgrazing and all of that. So this is kind of aimed at finding some solutions to that problem, to apply this regenerative grazing approach and actually monitor the vegetation response and see if they can't change the way federal agencies manage those grasslands. So those are kind of the major points of that. We hadn't really talked about this either, but native grasslands, I can't remember right off the top of my head the number of acres, but I mean, we're losing something like 1.2 million acres a year of native grasslands. Nick, you may have that stat. I don't have it right in front of me, but
all right, try to find it.
Yeah, it's an issue that we're dealing with. And, you know, we're losing native grasslands at a fairly rapid pace. And of course, I'm sure that's tied into the decline of grassland birds as well, is the loss of grasslands. One thing I think it's important to point out, typically when we talk about grasslands, we generally think of the Great Plains, you know, Northern Great Plains, Southern Great Plains. That's where most people, their mind goes when we talk about grasslands, but the Eastern United States historically were loaded with grasslands. The Kentucky Barrens, 3.2 million acres, the Grand Prairie in Arkansas was something like 500,000 acres. The Black Belt Prairie in Alabama was, I think, 1.2 million acres. All of Pennsylvania through the Ridge and Valley area, in the areas they called the gaps, which is the valley between the ridges, were loaded with native grasslands. I mean, bison were native to Alabama, were endemic to Alabama. We talk grasslands, we don't generally think about the grasslands of Eastern United States. And I can say from my perspective, I even consider like the pine savannas grasslands. Those are specialized grasslands that have a canopy of trees over them. But if you look at it, there's a herbaceous layer underneath that's full of big blue stem and wiregrass and Indian grass and a little blue stem. And those open pine stands are loaded with grasses. So, you know, one could argue, is it a woodland that's got a grass understory, or is it a grassland that has a wooded overstory?
Right.
I don't care what you call it, but it's great for quail, and we want to manage them to be open and have all those components that we're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a ballpark. ChatGPT tells me 70% of native grasslands lost in North America. And I mean, there's some stuff, and there's tall grass prairie, 99% lost, primarily in the Midwest and Great Plains. Mm-hmm. Mixed grass prairie, 70 to 80%, obviously high percentages. And some of that is just going to be part of a developing society. Over 200 million acres of native prairie have been destroyed since European settlement, but obviously people live here, and now it's sort of managing what we have and again, finding where working landscapes and wildlife habitat can intersect. I think most people understand that, but
right.
As we discussed earlier, it's an uphill battle at times, and it definitely takes awareness and advocacy on many, many levels.
Yeah. And I've just had a thought as we were talking about that, and we're talking about the loss of grasslands and working lands and the potential. We talk about tall fescue in particular within what we call the tall fescue belt, which is basically Missouri east to Virginia. And then there's roughly that's going to be it. It takes in parts of northern Alabama, northern Mississippi, northern Georgia, northern Arkansas, whatever. Within that area, there's about 35 million, or estimated to be about 35 million acres of tall fescue within that area. Most of that is under a grazing system of some sort. If we were able to convert 10% of that, 3.5 million acres. So if we go 30%, we're talking about what? 10.5 million acres to native warm season forages being managed correctly. 10.5 million acres. Do you think that would have an impact on bobwhite populations?
That's a lot of habitat.
Absolutely. The habitat potential for working lands just within the fescue belt is 10.5 million acres of bobwhite habitat. Wrap your head around that and see if we can't get a campaign going to do something there. That illustrates the importance of working lands and the ability of working lands. And oh, by the way, it's economically sound. Mm. It is beneficial to the producer to do that. Their bottom line will improve by incorporating that. Why can we not sell that message?
That's a good question.
Right.
And that's a healthy dose of optimism, which is necessary when you're looking at the top of the mountain. You need the attainable, achievable first step, and breaking it down like that in a smaller dose certainly makes it more palatable. And I worked in wildlife conservation, I guess, for a short period of time. I don't consider myself a professional in that industry, but it does seem like the biggest gains in wildlife conservation come when there's some sort of win-win. You know, the incentives need to be right. And that seems to be the message that needs to be in place for really good things to happen.
Yep. No, I agree. So, hopefully the Grasslands Conservation Act will help facilitate that. It'll stimulate some activity in that area and get people going. But in the meantime, I think our opportunity is to work with private industry and private individuals promoting native forages, because the way I view it, that's our low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
In terms of quail recovery, we have the best opportunity to make the most gains in that arena than we do about anywhere else. But I don't want to totally ignore the woodland, open woodlands with the herbaceous understory either. Our forests in the United States are so much in need of management, so much in need of management. I mean, you're a grouse hunter, you understand why Pennsylvania, yep, and Kentucky and Tennessee and Missouri don't have rough grouse anymore, or they have very limited populations, because we don't have active forest management going on at a scale big enough that makes a difference. And that's a pity.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a message that we've talked about a lot more on the show over the years, forest management. And again, to your point, you know, where I sit, I see the kind of the best of that with our timber industry that we still have in the Upper Great Lakes. And so it's kind of in my backyard, and I benefit from that and try to be appreciative of it every chance I get to be out in the woods. And I know that's not the case everywhere. So, yeah, from where you sit as director of National Bobwhite Grasslands Initiative, what would you have a listener take away from this? Is there a call to action? Is there something they could do, other than hopefully listening to this conversation and learning something about grasslands and quail? And
I got to think about that for a minute.
Are you guys a membership organization? I know you can donate. There's a button on the website, and I'll link everything up. But
yeah, not really. I mean, we have members, but it's our technical committee, and we just charge dues to help support our annual meeting and, you know, that kind of thing. We have a few expenses here and there, so we're not a membership organization. You know, that's not our niche. I mean, you know, quail forever, pheasants forever, rough grass. North American Grass Society, you know, those are the groups that are the membership approach. You know, our clients, our constituency are our state wildlife agencies that we deal with. So, you know, I think the main takeaway, I just some of the takeaways is that, first of all, working lands has got to be the solution. We've got to be the solution on working lands. The other one is we need to recognize that the eastern United States had a lot more grasslands than what we're currently seeing, what are currently there. You had mentioned 99% of tall grass prairie is lost. I would venture to say that 99.9% of eastern grasslands outside of tall grass prairie have been lost. That's not scientific, but I just know that it's just that it's significantly more than 99% of the tall grass prairie. I can tell you that. I mean, there's areas now that are covered in trees that were grasslands.
Right.
So to be aware of things that are going on, like the North American Grasslands Conservation Act, and if your constituency group or the group you're a member of, Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever, Rough Grass, whoever, they send out a call for action to support something with that, I think it'd be good to, you know, jump in and get involved in that. The other thing is, if you have any connections with private landowners, is start talking to them about native forages and or forest management, either one of those two things, and the advantages. And the really cool thing about forest management is that you don't have to be a quail hunter or a quail enthusiast to see benefit from that. If you're a deer hunter,
right?
If you're a turkey hunter, it's just unbelievable what kind of responses you get when you start doing forest management. It's just that the benefits are just so immense. I can't even hardly relate to you how much difference it makes. If you have an opportunity to get involved in a prescribed bird association, that's probably really good to do to help deliver prescribed fire on the ground. And there's some protections from liability by being involved in an association. So, you know, I'd look for that. Take the opportunity to stand up to the people that oppose active forest management. I've been to some meetings where they dominated the meeting, and unfortunately, the results were that nothing gets done. I've also been to the meetings where people in favor of active management dominated the meeting, and results got done. So you don't necessarily have to be political, but if you have the opportunity to show up at a meeting that opposes active forest management, you probably need to be there, particularly if you're a grass hunter. It's just nothing has killed grass populations worse than non-management, unmanaged forest. I mean, that's absolutely killed the sport.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think to ask you earlier, did you ever, is your farm in a place where there were grouse?
No.
Okay.
There might have, I think historically there would have been prairie grouse there.
Sure.
I mean, I remember as a kid seeing greater prairie chickens.
Really?
Right now I'm thinking of some of the places I saw them, probably not 5 miles from where I live. So I'm sure that historically, before people settled the area, that there were greater prairie chickens probably on my property.
Yeah.
When I look at the soils and what the USDA, they have a thing called an ecological site index. A large portion of my property was prairie. So historically.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you taking some time to chat with me and the listeners today. I definitely learned some new stuff and am now armed with more information, which is certainly a goal of most of the episodes we do here on the podcast. So I appreciate it. Keep up the great work. And hey, I'm here in the Birdshot podcast. Listeners are here. If you ever need to make the audience aware of anything, we appreciate what you're doing for us and everybody you work with. Obviously it's a collective effort.
Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I know this is a little different than what you normally do on your podcast. So that, I really appreciate you, kind of stepping out a little bit from what you do normally. And I do have to do this. You got to pay the piper, right? So I have to recognize a couple people here. First, I need to recognize Clemson University. That's administrative home for the National Bobwhite Grassland Initiative. Of course, all of our state fish and wildlife agencies within the 25 states that I'd given you that outline of earlier, they provide support to us. And then also the folks at Roundstone Native Seeds and Wildlife Drones. Those folks help support us financially and make it possible for me to take the time to do things like this and also get out and work on the things that we need to work on and try to improve the world for upland birds.
Indeed. Well, yeah, thank you to them. And once again, thank you for taking the time, Jeff. We appreciate it. NBGI.org. I will, of course, throw all the links in the show notes, but we'll have to do it again sometime, Jeff, and thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, you appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Nick.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.